What is your name, please?
Waddle and Sylvie.
Follow us on the gram at Waddle and Sylvie and at ESPN underscore Chicago. This is ESPN 1000.
Chicago's home for sports.
The NBA could be back in town, or at least in Orlando, very shortly. Woj, as we continue to trend towards a return to sports, and hopefully we can continue with it without any illnesses or, you know, postponements after we start up again. Woj tweeted a couple of minutes ago, Waddle, that according to ESPN sources, as the NBA models a 22-team format for July 31st resumption in Orlando, the proposed timeline for teams as the last possible date for an NBA Finals Game 7 is October 12th. The NBA's Board of Governors has a Thursday meeting set for a vote on a finalized plan to restart the season per sources. The league is still working through those details with the NBPA.
And then the remainder of the teams, just they stay at home.
They stay. When you were gone, the one thing that I would propose is you allow teams, if necessary, the right to have a training camp. So, like, what I would like to see the Bulls do is not with Jim Boylan, but with their new player development people, run practices for that 3-week training camp when all the other 22 teams start getting ready for their season. So that way, Karnišević and Eversley get to see Lauri Markkanen in a setting, get to see how a lot of these guys took the break. Kobe White, is that, what kind of a leader is Zach LaVine? Are they taking these practices seriously? And they won't provide all the answers, but I think a training camp before an offseason can give those new guys some good answers as opposed to not seeing them at all. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, I thought your idea of a draft lottery play-in tournament or a draft lottery tournament was also kind of appealing to me as a viewer.
And
as
I would love it, yeah. Send them
by the way, Shefty is also reporting that the NFL has told all of its teams that they must stay at their team facilities for this summer's training camp. So nobody will be able to be packing up their stuff and heading to a remote location to participate in training camp, much in the way the Bears have for years, either
Bourbonnais for the Bears
and
no fans is what a lot of the reporters are saying. Obviously, they were going to try and bring in fans, and maybe we'll do that in future years. But obviously, because of COVID situation, it's everything's going to be as limited as possible. So
they're building a hotel. Right, you know where you go to where the Bears are on Field Drive or whatever it is. I was told they were now building a hotel out there. It's in a, obviously, as you know, as you've been there, it's in kind of a business park. But also, I would think that this could be something that for training camp would be used as well for fans.
They're building a hotel in that office park?
In that area, yes.
Okay.
Not across the
it's
highway.
It's not a Bears hotel, is it? I mean,
No. I believe it's going to be a Hyatt.
The McCaskies aren't building that, and then they're going to complain that they don't have any money after they build a hotel and they can't pay their players anymore.
No, I don't think that's the case. But there is going to be a hotel. I was told by some of the Lake Forest City officials today that there's a hotel that's being built there.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah, very interesting, for sure. Stephen A. is going to hop on here in about 30 seconds. We're continuing the conversation, and we're listening as much as we can. We're giving you the floor. We think it's an important conversation. It's not what we normally do, but these are not normal times. 312-332-3776. So watch First Take every day. Stephen A. Does a great job on that. I know he was on vacation last week, and when everything happened, I saw the video that he did where he was really wanting to get back on Monday, and he went to his radio show to give his opinions as always. And whenever we've called Stephen A., whether it's busy times during the NBA playoffs or when he's in Chicago for the All-Star game, he's always picked up the phone for us. And we don't always disagree. We don't always agree, but that's what makes it so much fun. And Stephen A. joins us right now on ESPN 1000. Stephen A., how are you feeling?
How are you guys, man? I'm hanging tough. New York is
pretty wild right now, and that's where I'm at as we speak. Obviously, everybody knows, the world knows what's going on right now. So it's pretty rough, but we're hanging tough and staying safe and, you know, doing what you got to do to try to push everything forward.
Stephen A., as a black man in America, these hideous crimes are not new. These have been happening forever. The injustice has been a part of our society, unfortunately, for a long time. Do you have hope that maybe now, for whatever reason, this is a turning point going forward?
Well, it's a two-part answer to that. My answer would be yes, but the other part to the answer is that I'm clearly in the minority. There's an awful lot of black folks that I know, obviously, that don't feel that way. I'm optimistic, and it's not being an eternal optimist or anything like that, because God knows I can be skeptical and cynical as well. But I think that in this particular situation, it's a little bit different. When you see young white folks out there marching and protesting with black folks, when you see the plethora of athletes from the Carson Wentz and Tom Brady's of the world to so many others, speak out on behalf of not just George Floyd and his family, God rest his soul, but just the plight of black Americans and things that we've had to endure. And you see them being more outspoken than they've ever been. You have to take notice of that. And it's not just from an appreciative perspective. It's also from the perspective that if you're looking at the establishment per se, when we talk about the establishment, just so you know, I'm not breaking news here, but when black folks talk about the establishment and they talk about systemic racism, they're talking about white individuals in power. And the reality is that if you, in all likelihood, are one of those individuals, chances are you've got children on the come up. And if they're thinking differently and they're out there protesting and speaking out on behalf of black people and the plight that black Americans face throughout this nation, then take that into account for a second and imagine what kind of impact that can truly end up having, because they can't be ostracized. They can't be demonized. They can't be minimized, because the people that they're communicating with, although those are the ultimate people influencing our society, that's their parents. That's the adults that are in their life. And so that's what has me excited. The fact that you see young white folks speaking up and speaking on behalf of black Americans everywhere about what's transpiring. What it is.
Yeah, talking to Stephen A. Smith. It's Waddle and Sylvie on ESPN 1000. You and Max were having a good debate today about Tiger's statement, Tiger Woods' statement. Here's my question, because these conversations are uncomfortable. And rightfully so. They're not made to be comfortable. This is an uncomfortable spot where we are right now as a country. But I've also had something, I feel sometimes that when you wag the finger at somebody who wants to help, but you don't, you may be a little clumsy in your approach, but then someone you're not doing it right. You're not writing your statement right. You're not using the words correctly, that it puts someone else on the defensive and we're not productive for it. Where do you stand regarding that, where you start putting things under the microscope, whether this person is doing it right or they're not doing it right?
Well, to me, I thought that it was important to, you know, distinguish the difference. Like, for example, I don't know anybody in the black community that think that Tiger Woods has done much right outside of playing and winning in the sport of golf. In terms of representing or being a representative of black people in this country, I don't think anybody would deny that. We're not overly impressed with what Tiger Woods has done. Tiger Woods is somebody that's been on the record acknowledging that he doesn't necessarily acknowledge himself as a black man or see himself as a black man. I think the word cannibal and Asian or whatever it was, that's the first time I'd ever heard that word in my life. And that was something that Tiger Woods was on the record having said. So we all recognize that. We see that. And that didn't put him in our good graces, to be kind. But in the end, I also think it was important that when stuff like this happens, where some people deem it very, very easy for those in positions of influence to just come out and say the right things, everybody doesn't have the same oratorical skills. Everybody doesn't have the same conscience. Everybody doesn't have the same perspective, because a lot of times we come from a different perspective. We come from different cultural backgrounds, things of that nature. And we have to have a level of appreciation for that difference. It's a difference between being oblivious and being ignorant and then not caring. Those are two different things. If you don't know, you don't know. It's sad sometimes that people don't know. It's sad that they haven't opened their eyes and recognized the plight of others less fortunate than themselves. But if you are clueless and oblivious to a particular situation, that happens. The worst of them, as far as I'm concerned, is those who do know but don't give a damn. And I'm not sure that we can accuse the Tiger Woods of the world and others of being that bad. And that's the only point that I was trying to make to Max Kellerman when I had spoken early. Don't assume that everyone knows what we know. Don't assume everyone is as conscientious as we are. You guys host the radio show in Chicago. You do a fabulous job, as you have done for many, many years. A lot of people will say that you guys are conscientious, that you are aware of your situation. It does mean something to you, and it dictates how you act moving forward. There are a whole bunch of radio hosts that may not be that way, may not feel that way at all. And those are the kind of things that we have to take into consideration. We can't assume that everybody's the same. Everybody's made of the same ilk, the same level of toughness. I personally do not give a damn. I say what I mean what I say, and that is that. Others equivocate a lot and hedge their bets and do everything they can because they prioritize being careful and not offending folks as opposed to just speaking from their hearts. Everybody's different, and you got to respect that. Because if everybody were you guys, if everybody was me, we wouldn't be special.
Stephen A., I'm passionate about the concept of equal and fair opportunity, not just in the world of sports, but also in everyday life, but specifically in the world of sports. I know that the players, there's an appetite for the players to make a difference and to have their voices heard. Do you sense that there is the same appetite, level of appetite, with regard to ownership in the major sports for the same thing?
Of course not. Of course not. There's no appetite for that. Listen. If Michael Jordan wasn't Michael Jordan, he wouldn't own an NBA team. I could tell you, I could share a story with you that I think you guys know, but just in case you don't. How about when Bob Johnson got ownership of what he would later call the Charlotte Bobcats because the Hornets had taken their name to New Orleans? Do y'all remember that story? If you recall, Bob Johnson, the former founder of BET, ultimately he was worth about $1.7 billion. He wanted ownership of the NBA team, according to the story. And what happened was he was competing with Larry Bird's group because Larry Bird was looking to become an owner. This is before I think he had gotten on, he had become coach of the Indiana Pacers or whatever. Here's what happened. Larry Bird went in there, had about 13 or 14 members, and they were struggling to come up with the $300 million price tag. But he was Larry Bird. And so he was given every consideration under the sun by the NBA's Board of Governors, which obviously consisted of the commissioner and all the owners for each respective team. Bob Johnson followed. Bob Johnson had a longstanding relationship with Jerry Colangelo. Both of them had gone to the University of Illinois, if I remember correctly. And as the story goes, Bob Johnson said, "Hey, man, I appreciate everything that is Larry Bird and what he's meant to the game of basketball, et cetera, et cetera. But last time I checked, this was a business deal, and here is my financial portfolio. Who do I cut the check to?" That's what it took for a major sports league like the NBA to finally have a black owner in its sport. Now, most instances, it doesn't necessarily require that for white folks. If you speak to folks in the world of business, particularly in the world of sports, not to say that they don't have to have money, but essentially, you have to go through tremendous and strenuous circumstances to prove and validate your wealth. And even then, they don't want to let you in to that good old boys club. Okay, that's not the same with white folks. That's the difference. And that's just a microcosm of the kind of stuff that we have to deal with on considerably lower levels throughout our society. And we've been dealing with it for many, many years, many, many decades, obviously, if not longer. And I think that even though the pro sports leagues do a tremendous job of trying to ingratiate themselves to different demographics and try to engage in inclusionary tactics and things of that nature. It is still an uphill climb and an uphill battle every living day of our lives.
Stephen A., what is James Dolan's issue?
He's in my opinion, he's more of a petulant child than a grown man. He's a guy that reacts incredibly juvenile towards insults, towards skepticism. He engages in paranoia. And in my opinion, he just needs to grow up. Now, I say all of that recognizing this. As a black man, he does have a very, very good history with black people. Now, obviously, you got to take Anuka Brown Sanders into consideration because she was the one that filed a lawsuit and ultimately won a sexual harassment lawsuit against Madison Square Garden. At the time, Steve Mills was the president. Isaiah Thomas was running basketball operations. So he got sued as well, but he never had to pay anything. She won the case, and MSG was held liable, and they had to pay about $11.2 million. Shoving that aside, and I don't mean to do it so flippantly because I'm not trying to do that, but shoving that aside, James Dolan is known to have a stellar record of hiring African-American and women to executive positions within the MSG family. Here's the problem. He's childish. If you insult him, you're a little kid. He wants to have you removed and banned from the Garden. Oakley, according to him, was insulting him. He had Oakley physically removed. People have been in absolute paranoia because, you know, players had to monitor their text messages and things of that nature and their phone calls because they thought they were being tapped. These are the kind of things that are associated with James Dolan because he cares too much about, you know, what the headlines say. And he's prone to overreacting towards it. And in this particular instance where he spoke out, not spoke out, but he said that he gave an explanation internally, that is, as to why he wouldn't speak out and to why he was prohibiting others from speaking out. I think the things that he was not forthcoming about is that he's in a quandary. Because on one hand, he has contributed to multiple causes affecting the African-American plight. And obviously, he hires African-Americans as well. But on the flip side is he's very good friends with Donald Trump, and he's publicized that. And he's been on the record coming to Donald Trump's defense no matter who it was against or no matter what accusations have been levied against him. And I think because of that, he finds himself in a quandary because he doesn't know which way to move, and that's the situation that he's in right now.
Stephen, how do you believe the NFL will handle a potential situation in 2020, if in fact the season does begin, if there is a player or a series of players that want to mimic what Colin Kaepernick was involved with and his kneeling and his protesting back in 2000, I think in 16.
I think they will handle it vastly differently than what they did with Colin Kaepernick. We all know that Colin Kaepernick was blackballed. We all know that he was ostracized from the league because they thought it was bad for business. Joe Lockhart, the former communications guy that wrote his op-ed on CNN.com, acknowledged that owners thought he was bad for business. Even one owner projected that there would be a 20% loss in terms of ticket sales if indeed a team brought Colin Kaepernick on. And I truly, truly believe that when it comes to the NFL owners, that's what they care about. They care about dollars. Jerry Jones, when he had a meeting with the Dallas Cowboys, when he had a meeting with his team during the whole Colin Kaepernick situation, he said, this is not a football meeting. This is a business meeting. And from what I was told, articulated to those guys, this is going to cost me money if you take these positions. We in the South. This is a different world down here. And you can't do that and think that it's not going to affect my bottom line. And if it affects my bottom line, I assure you it's going to affect yours. And that was the message that he sent to guys. And you didn't see anybody from the Dallas Cowboys really speaking out on behalf of Colin Kaepernick. So those are the things that you have to pay attention to. Those are the things that you have to monitor, et cetera. And I think that the NFL owners are consistently thinking about that. They go after every penny. They don't mind having, they talk about safety, but they don't mind having football games on Thursday night. Plus their Saturday night during the postseason. Plus Sundays and Mondays, and oh, by the way, the preseason games, and oh, by the way, you know, now we're going to have a 17-game season. They don't care. They want that money. That's who they are. And in the end, They're not gonna waver from their position in any way. They are about getting paid. They are about maximizing the monetary opportunities that are presented to them. That's the way they think. That's who they are. I just think that in this particular case, the times that we're living in and how things are flowing, if another Colin Kaepernick situation reared its head, I think they would see the detriment to their bottom line that it would have by messing with somebody who elects to be that way. And that's why I think that it would be different.
So follow the money.
Follow the money.
Yeah.
Follow the money. Yes.
Stephen A., you're the best. We always appreciate your time. All the best to you, okay?
Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you, guys. Take care. Appreciate it.
There you go. Stephen A. Smith, always kind with his time for us. He just got back from vacation yesterday with obviously a full plate. They've been very busy, and he still manages time to call the show today. More Waddle and Sylvie coming up.
Waddle and Sylvie on ESPN 1000.
Follow at Waddle and Sylvie and at TWaddle87 on Twitter.
We've given you the floor today, the forum, your chance to use your voice, 332-3776 to get in. And we've still got another hour and a half to go. We've got to play some Ryan Clark, who is really good today on Get Up. And the Jason Hayward interview from yesterday, if you missed it, you won't want to miss it coming up at 5. This was outstanding as he continues to be a leader in the community and on the field as well. Carlos in L.A. has been patient. Carlos, you're on ESPN 1000. What's up?
Hey, gents. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to you guys for a long time, and I really miss listening to you guys out here. But I saw you tweeted out that you guys are having really interesting conversations, and you know, all I've been on hold this entire time, you know, it's really given me a lot of time to sort of think of the right words, and honestly, it's just so difficult. I'm a Mexican American. I grew up in Chicago, and I've certainly felt you know, discriminated against by the CPD at times, but I no means can ever understand what it feels like to be a black person in this country. And it's really given me this past week, seeing all the imagery on all the socials and in the news coverage, it's just, you know, given me, it's just made my heart so heavy and giving me a lot of time to reflect about what I can personally do and what, how I can be an ally to the black community. And this morning when I woke up, I got an email from, you know, I'm out here in L.A. as an actor, and I'm trying to pursue this acting career. And I get these emails from this organization called brainpickings.org. And they often send out really thoughtful and poignant emails. And one that I got this morning was from a man that really explained and was so eloquent with his words that we really need to look at the people that came before us in history, and especially those who were a part of the civil rights movement. And this email today was posted an essay from James Baldwin, who was a poet and a novelist during the civil rights era. And he wrote this this piece that I wanted to say, because I obviously am struggling to come up with the right words, and he lived through it as a gay black man. And I just wanted to read this little piece, this passage, if I could, from a 1962 essay titled The Creative Process. It says, perhaps the primary distinction of the artist is that he must actively cultivate the state which most men necessarily must avoid, the state of being alone. That all men are when chips are down alone is a banality. A banality because it is very frequently stated, but very rarely on the evidence believed. Most of us are not compelled to linger with the knowledge of our aloneness, for it is the knowledge that can paralyze all action in this world. There are forever swamps to be drained, cities to be created, minds to be exploited, children to be fed. None of these things can be done alone. But the conquest of the physical world is not man's only duty. He is also enjoined to conquer the great wilderness of himself. The precise role of the artist, then, is to eliminate that darkness, blaze roads through that vast forest, so that we will not, in all our doing, lose sight of its purpose, which is, after all, to make the world a more human-dwelling place. The state of being alone is not meant to bring to mind merely a rustic musing behind some silver lake. It is for that reason that all societies have battled with the incorrigible disturber of the peace, the artist. I doubt that future societies will get on with him any better. The entire purpose of society is to create a bulwark against the inner and the outer chaos in order to make life bearable and to keep the human race alive. And it is absolutely inevitable that when a tradition has been evolved, whatever the tradition is, the people in general will suppose it to have existed from before the beginning of time and will be most unwilling and indeed unable to conceive of any changes in it. They do not know how they will live without those traditions that have given them their identity. Their reaction when it comes, when it is suggested that they can or they must, is panic. And a higher level of consciousness among the people is the only hope we have, now or in the future, of minimizing human damage. And he finishes this with, the artist is distinguished from all responsible actors in society, the politicians, legislators, educators, and scientists, by the fact that he is his own test tube, his own laboratory, working according to very rigorous rules, however understated these may be, and cannot allow any consideration to supersede his responsibility to reveal all that he can possibly discover concerning the mystery of the human being. Society must accept some things as real, but he must always know that visible reality hides a deeper one, and that all our action and achievement rest on things unseen. A society must assume that it is stable, but the artist must know, and he must let us know, that there is nothing stable under heaven. One cannot possibly build a school, teach a child, or drive a car without taking some things for granted. The artist cannot and must not take anything for granted, but must drive to the heart of every answer and expose the question the answer hides. And lastly, anyone who has ever been compelled to think about it, anyone, for example, who has ever been in love, knows that one fact that one can never see is one's own face. One's lover or one's brother or one's enemy sees the face you wear, and his face can elicit the most extraordinary reaction. We do the things we do and feel what we feel essentially because we must. We are responsible for our actions, but we rarely understand them. It goes without saying, I believe, that if we understood ourselves better, we would damage ourselves less. But the barrier between oneself and one's knowledge of oneself is high indeed. There are so many things one rather not know. We become social creatures because we cannot live any other way. But in order to become social, there are a great many other things that we must not become. And we are frightened, all of us, of these forces within us that perpetually menace our precarious security. Yet the forces are there. We cannot will them away. All we can do is learn to live with them. And we cannot learn this unless we are willing to tell the truth about ourselves. And the truth about us is always at variance with what we wish to be. The human effort is to bring these two realities into a relationship resembling reconciliation. Thank you guys so much,
Carlos,
for
thank
taking
you.
My call.
Thank you. There you go, from James Baldwin. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Carlos.
We got to take more calls at 312-332-3776. And Ryan Clark tells a personal story about him growing up and his experience with all this. That's next.
Coming up next.
Waddle and Sylvie on ESPN 1000, Chicago's home for sports.
Bring Waddle and Sylvie with you at home or in your office. Just tell your smart speaker to play ESPN 1000.
There are sports to get to as well today. We'll reiterate what Woj is reporting with the new NBA and the 22-team field. A lot of questions unanswered going forward and how we're going to see some of these sports leagues play. Baseball's still trying to figure it out from 50-game seasons to 114-game seasons. But we're having the conversation of where we are today as a world, and 332-3776, taking as many calls as we can, giving your voice an opportunity to be heard on our show while we listen. I want you to listen to this. This is important. Meller, you also agreed that this was outstanding from former Pittsburgh Steeler Ryan Clark.
Oh, yeah,
correct?
It was very moving. I think Ryan Clark articulates, you know, just what it's his own personal experience, but it was very moving.
So this is a personal story, something that he experienced, and he wove it together to where we are today as a society. Take a listen.
You know, I think the conversations have been different this time. I know for sure my phone has rang and my text messages have beeped with non-blacks reaching out to me to, you know, to let me know that they're listening, to let me know that they're a part of trying to find a solution or at least a part of caring. It definitely makes me wonder why, you know, why now? Eric Garner, he couldn't breathe either. You know, Breonna Taylor, she wasn't even in a position to defend herself in her own home. And so whereas you are, I guess, excited or at least sort of starting to feel a little comfort in the fact that other people are listening, I think it's still extremely, extremely difficult. I'm no longer angry. I'm no longer mad. I'm just disappointed. I'm sad. It's heavy. And so now I think it's about trying to find a solution moving forward, about people actually listening and putting those things that they learn into action. You know, I grew up in New Orleans. I grew up in the South. I was a 19-year-old black kid who had a child with a white woman, you know, and that family seemed to love me. They loved the fact that I played ball and I was extremely intelligent. But I remember the first conversation once we found out we were having this child. I was no longer this great athlete. I was no longer this straight A student. I was the N-word from down the street who played football, who wouldn't take care of his child. And I remember 2 years later going to pick up Jaden from her grandparents' house and her grandfather running after me to apologize to me because he didn't know. And if he never, and he passed shortly after, but if he never had that experience with me, to him, black people were never good enough to be a part of their family. See, I was good enough to live down the street and I was good enough to watch play ball, but I wasn't good enough to be a part of their family. And now I'm moving on and raising this child in the house with my African-American wife, my other two children. They're all the same to me. I treat them all the exact same way. My daughter being half of something that I'm not doesn't keep me from loving her, you know, and that's what we want from America, right? The fact that we're different shouldn't keep you from loving us. And that's kind of what we've seen. And I don't know if it's because the act was just so nonchalant, so heinous, so uncaring, because there was no part of that man, of Officer Chauvin, that seemed slightly sympathetic, empathetic, that even cared about the person he was kneeling on and taking his breath. Maybe that's why people spoke up, or maybe because Carson Wentz and Zach Ertz said something, now white people feel it's okay to reach out. And it's hard to raise a child and to have my son, when he gets his license, he ran a stop sign. They said he rolled through, and I didn't necessarily punish him or get mad at him. I was like, you got to drive better. Then he got pulled over for speeding. And I remember my wife being so mad at me, like, Ryan, you got to do more. You need to punish him. You need to get on him. You need to do this. And I was like, well, why, babe? He's just driving. But she said, because every time they pull him over, that's another opportunity they get to shoot him. And you know, if they shoot him, nobody will fix it. And he'll never be back. And that's every single day. And whereas I am excited that people actually care this time, I hate that we're tearing down our own communities. I hate that we're tearing down our own stuff. I hate that we are not working to build instead of destroy, but at least they're listening. And I also wonder, we have all this systematic outrage, this institutional outrage, which it's not run by us, right? Like when I got an opportunity to talk this morning, I was told, don't say this, or you can't say that, or it's cool to be in this place, but you can't be here, because we don't make no rules. We don't make the rules. And so when you don't make the rules, you can't make the change. And so we're talking about everybody's, what can we do? What can we do? You got to vote. You got to be different. You got to act different. You got to treat people different. You got to love differently. You got to teach differently. And when people are mad to have AR-15s at the Capitol in Michigan because they can't go to salons and because they can't go to beaches and because they can't do these things that they feel like they are entitled to freaking do, but there's no outrage. Because we tear down the Confederate past in Charlottesville, Virginia, and there's outrage and there's mad, but where's the systematic outrage? Where's the institutional? Where the rubber freaking bullets? They ain't there. And so if we want to change stuff, we got to change how we deal with it. You can't tell us how to grieve. You can't tell us that you can be this mad, but you can't be that mad, because you ain't dying. And so when I do feel better that people are listening. It still ain't better for us. And when you hear, if you don't like it, go back to your country. This is my freaking country. I was born in Algiers, New Orleans, Louisiana, the USA. And it's not that we don't love it here. I love a lot of things that I could like better if they were different. And so I am encouraged that people are listening. I am, I do feel like there's some validation in many things that I've said, that I've felt, that I've protested against. Many times I've reached out in the community to try to make change. I just hope that now moving forward, the next thing isn't black people shouldn't do this. Why are you so angry? Hopefully now, since they are listening, since you tell me you're listening, you've listened enough to know why we're so pissed off.
That wasn't scripted. That was nope. Ryan Clark is one of my favorite analysts, Waddle.
Yeah. Speaks from the heart. Always, you know, I think his football thoughts are great. Passionate about football, passionate about life. And again, I keep coming back to, it was Ryan there. I heard Marcus Spears earlier in the week on Get Up, obviously yesterday, right?
Yes.
And it's such a frightening realization, as I've said, and I've probably said it 10 times now, that as parents, we're all worried about our kids, okay? What they're going to drive too fast, what they're going to do, where they're going to go, what they're going to eat, what they're going to, how successful, you know, all that other stuff. Well, Marcus Spears and Ryan Clark have the same concerns about their kids. But they also have to worry about whether or not when their kid gets stopped for speeding too far, their concerns are significantly more than mine.
Yeah.
And it's...
Look, I was saying that to Hoodie yesterday. Like, that isn't that the most sickening feeling? You're, like, driving. I got a ticket once coming back from an appearance Lake in the Hills. I was going down one of those, four-lane highways to get to 90 too fast. Or... You know, one of my last tickets I got on the Kennedy, the guy pulled me over right on Addison. Like, just, you know, we all love to drive fast. And then you see that cop in your rearview mirror and you're like, please, lights don't go on. Please, lights don't go on. And we've got nothing to worry about except a $180 ticket, $160 right. ticket. You know, a pain in the ass that, I'm going to be delayed now 20 minutes while he writes me a ticket. And I've got to now go to court, or I've got to do driver school.
Like, you're worried about your insurance rates.
Yeah, it's my insurance rate. Like, that's nothing. That's nothing because of, you know, the differences in where we are today. And it's, you know, it's really something. And that should end forever.
Well, there are a lot of things that have resonated over the last several days. But, you know, as a man, a father of kids, that's one that really hits home for sure.
Yeah. Good stuff from Ryan Clark. I want to get you updated on what Woj had to say today about the NBA. I have a question for you about the Bulls, Waddle, and all of this. And then at 5 o'clock, we're going to hear from Jason Hayward, the interview from yesterday. It's can't miss, and we'll play it for you at 5.
You're listening to Waddle and Sylvie on ESPN 1000.
Chicago's home for sports.
Follow at Waddle and Sylvie and at TWaddle87 on Twitter.
By reading this piece that is now live on ESPN.com, Woj put out there the possibility for the NBA with a 22-team format. July 31st to resume play in Orlando. The Game 7 of the NBA Finals then would be October 12th if needed. The votes from the Board of Governors is going to happen on Thursday, and there's still some things that need to be worked out. But this is the way it would go, Waddle. It says the NBA has been advancing on a plan that would include regular season play-in and playoff games for 16 teams currently holding playoff position and 6 more teams with 6 games of the 8th seed in each conference, sources said. Those teams would include New Orleans, Portland, San Antonio, Sacramento, and Phoenix in the West, and Washington in the East. So it would not include the Bulls. So this has been my question for, like, a team involving the Bulls. Do those teams who, quote, don't make the playoffs, that are playing in this 22 team thing. Like, I don't know how they're going to do it or what they're going to deem a playoff, if it's going to be expanded or if play-in will be like making the postseason. Should those last eight teams that aren't invited to go here be the only eight teams in the lottery?
It's a really good question. I saw Stephen A. screaming at Jalen today about, I think Jalen's proposal was everyone gets in.
Everyone gets in the lottery, or everyone gets in the playoffs.
And then you just kind of play a tournament. You know, I didn't see all of the details of that. Should the eight teams, only the eight teams that are included, then ultimately be included in the lottery? I don't know how you do that though. I mean, because if you're not in the postseason, it's always been, then you are part of the lottery, correct?
Yes, but I mean, if you're going to expand it and have a play-in for the playoffs, which you've never had, is that like making the playoffs? So, I mean, does New Orleans get a chance not only to play into the playoffs when they're not in it currently with Zion, and then if they don't, now they get a double dip. They get to double dip their chip, and they get the opportunity for the number one pick. Is that fair?
You could convince me that the teams that aren't getting an opportunity could then be the only ones that are involved in the lottery. But my question would be, would that be something that the owners would universally agree to?
I don't know, but it's important for the teams because the NHL, like the Hawks, normally would not be in the postseason. But they're going, 24 teams in the NHL are getting in. And so the Hawks are going to play Edmonton in this, quote, first round of the postseason. Right. So they're not eligible for the lottery under the NHL rules. Only the seven remaining teams are allowed.
I can understand why there would be a lack of equity with regard to that. It would not be an equal, based on what the previous rules were. Because I haven't really thought about this deeply. I'm not trying to evade it. I'm trying to process
as
we go along.
I don't view it, though. I feel like if you play your way in, the play-in, like, I guess the play-in, it's a little different. Because if you play your way into the playoffs, then obviously
you've earned a financial reward.
Yeah, and you're not going to be in the lottery. But for the teams who are trying to play in but get bounced, I have no problem with them being tossed in or, you know, being put back into the lottery.
Really?
Yeah, that's what my
because I don't
was.
Think they're gaining anything, any huge advantage from being in this play-in tournament. And if you legitimately, if you want them to, because remember, we heard also there was some resistance. Some teams weren't like, or we had this discussion, Sylvie, where some teams might not even want to be involved in the play-in.
We talked about this Friday.
You know, if it took them out of the lottery. So I think if you miss the playoffs through this play-in tournament, I'm okay with you being put back in the lottery.
Yeah, because think about this. I'm looking at the standings currently. When the season was halted, the Hornets had a 23-42 record in the East. The Bulls were 22-43. So, I mean, like, it's... The difference is so small. I'm with Meller. If you play your way into the postseason, the reward is there's going to be financial reward involved. If you can't get into the postseason, I think you go into the lottery.
And I don't know what the playoff field is going to be. Is it still going to be like 16, or will they count
in
the play-in? Will they count the play-in as the postseason? Because Greeny and Jalen have a bet that New Orleans is going to make the playoffs or not. Greeny's has them making the playoffs. And if they make this expanded playoffs, he wins the bet by unfairly almost.
Right. I got to wait to see what they vote on and what they end up saying. And it's going to be the top 22 teams. And then what?
You have to be within six games, because no team has ever made up like a bigger deficit than five. So they're allowing teams within six games. And remember, I think Washington can come back with John Wall now, who wasn't healthy.
Right. Think about it. Okay, so the number eight seed currently in the East is Orlando with a 30-35 record. Okay, so they're the eighth seed. The next team behind them is 5.5 games back.
That's the Wizards. They're basically going to be the only two Eastern Conference teams that are going to be eligible for this play-in.
Right, and what you're looking to do is earn the number eight seed, right? Isn't that correct?
Yes.
So
will the number eight seeds have to play in too? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So I mean, like, that's a lot of teams would say, well, that's not fair either. That, I mean, we're the eight seed, you know.
Well, that's what I'm asking, too. So, like, the number seven seed is Brooklyn. They're 30-34.
Right.
They're half game ahead of the Orlando Magic. Are they also having to continue to play for one of these final seeds, or are they locked in because they're locked in because they're not?
No, I don't think we've seen all the details as to how specifically that's going to play out.
So I guess my answer to your question then would be, without knowing all of the details and how it's going to play out, if you find your way in as one of the 16 playoff teams, if you're number 16, you're 15, you're 14, whatever the case may be, I think your financial reward is your reward. The other teams, the other 14 teams, are going into the lottery. Whether or not you had the access to
you're still
to
having your regular size lottery. Yes. You're still cool with that.
I am.
We'll see. As a Bulls fan, I obviously don't want that to happen. You know, I'm biased. I'm not saying that it makes sense. But I'm saying that, like, there's going to be a new way to make the postseason this year. And if you simply have that opportunity, and I know what Mellor's saying, some would maybe choose the other way. But they would probably be admonished for it. I'm just saying, I think if you can't have both.
I like your concept of a tournament for the lottery.
Yeah. Let Steph come back fantastic. And let's see the Warriors play in it. I'd like to see how the Bulls would play in that.
Now, I get it. I don't know that Damian Lillard may decide that it's not something that he's at. You may have people. There are going to be players that decide not to play, whether it's Major League Baseball, it's the end. That's my guess. I don't believe you're going to have 100% participation.
I think more that's so a wild in the guess? NBA. I think in the NBA, you will, because it's just a short sprint. I mean, shorter. With baseball,
NBA is going to have a bubble city. So
I'm
with Sylvie. I think the NBA might have 100% participation.
But baseball, I think that's going to be a huge thing this year, Waddle. Who may make the decision not
right.
to?
Right. If you're a guy making 35, who's made 5 years of $35 million a year, you have security, you have a young family, and you don't like the terms that your team potentially or your union could potentially agree to, I think you're going to have guys that don't participate in 2020.
I'm not saying I would. I would say some people are going to say I'd skip it. Yeah, that they're going to just skip it. All right, speaking of baseball, Jason Hayward for Can't Miss Radio joined us yesterday to talk about the current state of our country. That's coming up in two short minutes.